for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. ISIS widens its terror campaign, targeting Assyrian Christians and ancient relics. The EU's foreign policy chief says the major powers working on a nuclear agreement with Iran are getting close to a deal. And Ukrainian and pro-Russian separatists withdrew some heavy weaponry from the front lines, but a ceasefire remains fragile. Joining me for the week's top international stories on the Friday News Roundup, David Sanger of the New York Times, Joanna Biddle of Agence France-Presse, and Jim Sciutto of CNN. You are invited to join the conversation. Give us a call at 800-433-8850. Send us an email to drshow@wamu.org. Follow us on Facebook or send us a tweet. And good morning to all of you.
Morning, Dave.
Good morning.
Great to be here.
Good to see you. Jim Sciutto, ISIS abducted hundreds in Syria this week. What do we know?
Well, it's just the latest in their targets, right? No one is safe from them. It started with the Yazidis, of course, last year, and that's what's helped to start the U.S.-led military campaign against ISIS, and has continued. You know, this is not just Christians and Yazidis and minorities. It is Shia Muslims, but even Sunni Muslims who don't buy their particular brand of the faith. So now these Christians, and what you're seeing here is ethnic cleansing, really, at the human level, abducting the men, women, and children. Sadly, presumably, the men will be killed. The women and children, you know, really put into sexual slavery. But also you're seeing as well a cleansing of history as they break all these museum pieces as well. You know, I've been up to this part of the country, and it is so sad because it's a living museum, right? I mean, you have these ancient architectural relics as well as artifacts, you know, stored in these museums, and to see them broken to pieces one by one as human lives are being destroyed. I mean, they're really trying to wipe the slate clean. Yeah. I also think one final thing, that they're seeking to strike fear in our hearts as well. They know how to draw attention in the West. You go after Christians, you behead Westerners, you destroy antiquities. This is aimed at us.
Joanna.
Well, yes, exactly. I mean, I think we've seen this before in previous conflicts, of course, where we had the Buddha statues in Bamyan in Afghanistan that were destroyed by the Taliban back in the early 2000s, I believe. And then we also, in Timbuktu in northern Mali, there was some attempt to try and destroy ancient scripts as well. A lot of those were smuggled out. So I believe some of the terms people are using now is that this is a kind of cultural genocide, an attempt to wipe out anything that in this extreme form of Islam is seen as idolatry or countering their faith.
So, David Sanger, what happens now to these people?
Well, we don't know, but we fear what happens to the Assyrian Christians who have been captured. But there may also be another motive in the fact that this attack happened in Mosul and happened in a way, as Jim said, to gather such incredible publicity to it. There is a theory kicking around within the Pentagon and the Obama administration that what they're trying to do is accelerate the American attack to retake Mosul, or I should say the Iraqi army attack, which would be backed, of course, by the United States. And if that happens, they want to do two things. First, I think they would rather take on the Iraqis before the Iraqis are ready for this battle. And all the indications we've had as the Pentagon first announced that there would be an effort to retake Mosul and then sort of walk that back is that the Iraqis clearly aren't ready yet. But the second thing is they may want a dramatic attack that is useful for them to continue the recruitment. You know, it struck me in the Times today where we quoted one Iraqi expert as saying they want to fight with the West because that's how they gain credibility and recruits. They want boots on the ground. They want another Fallujah. And, of course, that's a reference to the 2004 battle, which was the biggest ground engagement the United States had had since Vietnam. And it took the city back from al-Qaeda, but it also helped give birth to the ISIS movement.
So it's just getting worse and worse. But the question becomes how long they may have to wait for those boots to be on the ground.
It does. And there's also another calculus going on here in Washington and among the European allies, Diane, which is groups like ISIS can burn out. We saw this happen when al-Qaeda led to the al-Qaeda-related occupations in Iraq, led to a greater uprising in some of the what became known as the Awakening. And, of course, the Islamic State wants to be a state. And that means that over time, they're going to have to figure out how you go provide for people, how you get medical care, how you get food. So you can grab headlines by going in, destroying antiquities, by kidnapping people. But over time, it may accelerate the time at which they burn themselves out.
But the question becomes, how are they continuing to recruit people to join their cause? I mean, not just these three young teenagers, girls, as a matter of fact, but people from all over the world.
Well, that's right. It is a baffling question, I think, and the question that really governments around the world are struggling with. There are estimations now that as many as 20,000 foreign fighters have joined ISIL since 2012, which is much higher recruitment level than was ever seen, for instance, during the war in Afghanistan. Of those, about 4,000 are believed to be Westerners, so from Western European countries, Britain, France, Holland, Belgium. And among those, yes, there's startling numbers of young girls, as we saw. Something like 550 young girls have gone from these countries across the border, smuggled in through Turkey into Syria. And as a parent myself of a teenager, it's absolutely horrendous to think that a young child could be able to get that far. And it begs the question, there must be some kind of trafficking network or smuggling network going on to get them across the borders.
But they are doing this through social media, Jim.
They are extremely successfully. You have the FBI director admitting that they can't keep up with that social media campaign. And just to extrapolate on Joe's point, we've seen the whole range, the enormous range that ISIS attracts just in the last week. You have Jihadi John in the UK. My colleague Peter Bergen called him the bourgeois jihadi. You know, fairly well off, fairly well educated, he goes. You had these three teenagers in Brooklyn, a little more of the bumbling category of recruits to ISIS. You have these three young British girls a week ago from middle-class families who choose to travel on their own. And just yesterday, you had some Canadian kids leaving Montreal. So you see this enormous range. At the same time, of course, you have an enormous pipeline from the Middle East, too. We don't want to say all focused.
What is being offered? What is the lure?
This is the thing, and it's interesting, because it reminds me of what lured people to the fight in Iraq against U.S. forces there as well. It's not entirely new. It is partly religious, possibly principally religious, but it's not purely religious. It is a cause. It's an identity. It is political. It arises from a sense of victimization, a sense of humiliation. And that has a very powerful message. And when you speak to them, they truly are convinced, right? And I often say to people, you assume that they're crazies, that they're nuts. The sad fact is, yes, they attract some crazy people, but some of them are quite sane and making sane, though bad, decisions to go fight.
You know, it captures people. I think what Jim and Joe said was just right, but it captures young people just at that moment when they are most searching for themselves, most searching for a deeper cause, who, you know, in another era, an era of protest on campuses, might become somewhat radicalized or at least quite passionate on some other cause. And ISIS has got a clear and dramatic story to tell of purity and clarity here. And part of the difficulty, I think President Obama struck at this 2 weeks ago at the extremism summit that they held here in Washington, is that the counter message from the West has been, frankly, pretty boring. And you know, the most, if you ask people at Google or some other places where they're trying to help along in countering these messages, they'll tell you that the best messages in return have actually come from former jihadis who have defected and explain what life is really like. It has not come from saying, no, this message is wrong.
And how much do we know what life is really like for these young defectors?
Oh, for the well, there was a very interesting video which emerged about 10 days ago from a German journalist, Jürgen Turtenhofer, I think his name was, which was put up on the BBC. He actually got permission from Islamic State to go into Mosul and film with his son the conditions of life there. He believed it was because they wanted to show that Islamic State was working, but of course it was a very risky business. He had a permission slip from them that they wouldn't kidnap him and his son. And what emerged, I watched parts of the video this morning, what emerged from it was this incredibly disciplined and oppressed society where everybody is taught how to pray and dress.
Joanna Biddle, she's State Department correspondent for Agence France-Presse, Jim Sciutto of CNN, David Sanger of The New York Times, and we'll take a short break right back.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Vicky and Roger Sant and Island Press, which offers solutions to environmental problems in print, in person, and online at islandpress.org. From CA Technologies, who believes that in the application economy, every business is in the software business. CA makes software to empower enterprises and help them thrive. More information is at ca.com. And from the Ford Foundation, working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide at fordfoundation.org.
Welcome back to the International Hour of our Friday News Roundup. This week with Jim Sciutto of CNN, Joanna Biddle of Agence France-Presse, and David Sanger of The New York Times, and author of Confront and Conceal, Obama's Secret Wars and Surprising Use of American Power. We were talking during the break about Jihadi John. Who is he, David Sanger?
Well, Jihadi John is remarkable in part. His full name is Muhammad Emwazi. Remarkable in part because his story seems so parallel to Muhammad Atta, the 9/11 plotter, you'll remember, who came out of an extremely prominent or at least wealthy background. And in the case of Mr. Emwazi, he grew up in London, in North London. He was part of what they used to call the North London Boys. It was a group of, in one way, very westernized, and in other ways, a great adherence to an extreme version of their religion.
He had quite a good education.
A very good education
Britain.
In computer science. He apparently did pretty well in school. He was not wanting in any way for money. He was certainly employable. And in fact, his friends described him as somebody who they thought was essentially pretty peace-loving. And so the whole concept that he was the one standing there with this commando knife doing the beheadings was, I think, a shock to many of them.
How do we know?
Well, how do we know that he...
He is as he is. Yeah.
Well, he's been known. This is a gentleman who's been known to British security services for some years, it turns out, for 6 years. That doesn't mean guilt by its own fact, but there were some signals. There was travel to Tanzania, which was suspected that he was actually wanted to go on to Somalia to fight there, which was a real cause célèbre among these young Muslim communities at the time.
And he was detained on his way in that Tanzania by the British and the Dutch.
Which his friends said sparked his radicalization. But let's be honest here. There's a deeper story, because in 2011 he turns up in court papers for being tied to a group that was funneling money to al-Shabaab. So there was something there, and this gets at what is a new story, but also a challenge. Missed signals with the case. He was known to security services. They made a judgment that he was not a real risk, and of course he turns out to be one. This recalls the situation with the Kouachi brothers in Paris, the shooters at Charlie Hebdo. They were known to French security services for a number of years. They were under surveillance. They took them off surveillance because they judged them not to be a threat. Yeah. Of course, hindsight is 20/20, but it does show that these countries have, in the UK, you have hundreds who have gone to fight in Iraq and Syria, many more who sympathize with jihadism. Same in France. Security services cannot surveil every one of them. It just would take tens of thousands of security agents, so you miss some. Now, in the States, the figure has now been raised to 180. Not anything on a par with the UK, but there are many other sympathizers, and even in the US, it's impossible to follow them all. So some fall through the cracks.
Oh, yes, absolutely. I think the French authorities said after the Charlie Hebdo attacks that there are about 3,000 people that they should be keeping an eye on 24 hours a day. How do you do that? How do you do that in countries also recognizing that a lot of these European countries, their budgets have been under severe strain, national budgets. Some of those cuts have gone in things like policing and intelligence services, not the bulk, but some of it. So it becomes very difficult. And David Cameron was out this morning, the Prime Minister of Britain, defending MI5, saying we will do everything we can to find Jihadi John, to bring him back to justice, but we simply cannot keep an eye on everyone.
But Jihadi John really belies the narrative that we've had for so long that, in fact, these young men going to join ISIS had no work, had no alternatives, had no money, that they were underprivileged.
Well, you know, that's the same initial narrative that we had after 9/11, but when you looked at the 19 hijackers from Saudi Arabia, most of them from Saudi Arabia, you discovered that many, as in the case of Mohammed Atta, didn't fit that here. And listen to this email that Mr. Emwazi sent to one of his friends in 2010 when he had been banned from returning to Kuwait, which had refused to renew his visa. And he blamed the British government, and he wrote, "I had a job waiting for me and a marriage to get started, but now I feel like a prisoner, only not in a cage in London." Okay, now, as Jim points out, there's a lot more, you know, to this story. But if you're feeling like you are oppressed by the system, once the surveillance starts and the visa bans begin, it feeds your own self-image of yourself as somebody who is not only a victim, but someone who is going to bring about retaliation. And it's astounding when you consider the barbarity of what we have seen.
Exactly. And if he is, in fact, the one who's carried out these executions over and over again.
Oh, I find it very difficult to imagine that in today's society somebody could wield a knife over the neck of somebody else, and not just once, but repeatedly. It is blood-curdling to me. But I think also the story of Jihadi John, plus the stories that we've talked about today, goes back to Jim's point that there are a complexity of reasons for why people across the world are joining ISIL. And I'm not sure exactly how you are going to be able to stop all of these different streams from joining.
That's a really, really good question. I mean, with social media and with ISIL smart enough, clever enough to present itself in very enticing ways and drawing young people in, by virtue of sparking their imagination as to what lies ahead. You know, I think people have to be very concerned. David, tell us about the high-level talks over Iran's nuclear program. They wrapped up on Monday. What's the status of negotiations?
For the first time, Diane, in the whole 18-month run of this drama since the negotiations began, you actually have American and European officials saying they actually think they're getting near an agreement. The details that we're learning about this agreement make you wonder how enduring it would be, both if it hit the United States Congress, and Congress, of course, would be required eventually, not immediately, to lift the sanctions against Iran. And you wonder whether parts of it are actually going to be acceptable back in Tehran. And, of course, next week we're going to have the political drama of having Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu come here and address that joint session of Congress that many American officials, including Vice President Biden, have said they'll be unavoidably out of town.
Out of the country.
Yes, right. And so will Secretary of State Kerry, who will actually be out negotiating in Switzerland the agreement that Netanyahu will be up in Congress warning against.
Virtually at the same time, I think.
the same moment. So this raises the question, how is it that an agreement could look so near and so potentially satisfactory to the administration and so abhorrent to Prime Minister Netanyahu? And the answer to that lies in what your objective is. President Obama has consistently said since the beginning of his presidency that he would not let Iran get a nuclear bomb. Prime Minister Netanyahu has consistently said he would not let Iran get a nuclear capability. And in those two words lies a huge void of difference.
Interesting. Joanne.
Well, exactly. I think Secretary Kerry was obviously up on the Hill for 2 days this week and talking exactly about this. He got pummeled with a lot of questions. Obviously, Congress is very keen to know what exactly the details are. And he said that because there's been some discussion about how long the deal would last, and there's been some erroneous...
10 years or 20 10 years.
Well, the administration has talked about double digits, so of course that could run from 10 years to 99 years.
Mm-hmm. Right.
It's probably much closer to 10 years,
right.
Somewhere around
right.
there. But there's been some erroneous kind of misunderstanding, I think, that once the deal is over, whatever that period is, that Iran would then be free to build a nuclear bomb. Mm. And actually, as Secretary Kerry said, they are forever forbidden from having a nuclear weapon because they are actually signatories to the NPT.
Uh-huh.
Although, of course, they have been in violation of the NPT for some time over their enrichment activities.
What difference could Prime Minister Netanyahu make, assuming his speech to Congress does move forward? What difference could that speech make in the administration's decision to go forward?
Well, clearly the administration has made a decision to ignore Netanyahu's position. Now, but it can still have an effect because he's a very powerful voice here in Congress, and Congress has a role. If they're not happy with this agreement, they will certainly be pushing for additional sanctions. And in fact, as you know, they've been pushing for additional sanctions already without even knowing the final details of the agreement. So, you know, the ship has sailed already on how the administration will respond to his criticism, but there are many other roadblocks that can be generated and made worse by his speech here. The bigger picture point I would make is this, is that I've been going to Iran for 15 years, and when you look at this, these negotiations are a truly remarkable experiment. Can you come to a diplomatic resolution with really one of your worst allies, adversaries, on one of the worst issues, most intractable issues, nuclear proliferation? Can you come to a diplomatic resolution? It's a remarkable experiment. And when you speak to U.S. diplomats, they'll say, well, listen, we have made difficult agreements before with difficult adversaries, arms control agreements with the USSR, the former USSR. So there's, and in fact, they use that as a model to say, listen, you may not trust the other side, but you verify and so on to say that there's still a way forward. But boy, if they can manage all of those differences and get to that final, you know, bridge those final gaps, it'll be pretty remarkable.
Well, Jim's right on this, but for every example you can get where we have managed an agreement with an adversary, there's usually a pretty good counterexample, and the Israelis have one that they offer up, which is North Korea. Mm. You know, we reached agreements at the end of the Bush administration to try to dismantle North Korea's infrastructure. Things went into the deep freeze. The North Koreans reconstituted that infrastructure, and they're back in the bomb-making business again. Let me pick up for a moment
and
on something.
And I would just add, and Iran has broken previous agreements before as well. So,
right.
So they're bad,
right.
Bad precedents in this own relationship.
Yeah. So these are fraud, and you can pick the example to back your position. Yeah. Let me pick up on something that Joe mentioned, which I half agree with and half disagree with. She's absolutely right when she says that even after these agreements expire, Iran will be prohibited from building a weapon. The part that's hard for President Obama and for Secretary Kerry is that after these agreements expire, Iran will be free to enrich as much uranium and to reprocess as much plutonium as they want to on an industrial scale, which would take them to inches from a bomb. And that's the problem that many of the critics of the accord have, which is you're basically rolling the dice that by the time this agreement expires, 10 years, 15 years, whatever it's going to be, it'll probably be closer to 15, that you've got a different regime that you can fundamentally trust in Iran. That's a big bet.
And I would like to remind you, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. The deadline, the end of March, but then the final deadline sometime in June.
That's right. They have agreed to have a political framework by March 31st, hence the intensity of the meetings, the pace gathering up. Secretary Kerry just came back on Monday. He's going out from meeting with his Iranian counterpart, Minister Zarif, twice in Geneva on Sunday and Monday last week. He goes back out again on he will meet again on Monday with the Russian foreign minister, Lavrov, and then on Tuesday he will meet again with Zarif. So the intensity, the pace of these negotiations is stepping up because on March the 31st they want to have this political framework. What the framework will look like is, I think, part of the question. The State Department say they want it to tie down some broad outlines of areas where they agree, but then, yes, they've actually left the technical details to be finalised by June 30th. And I think between those two dates, there's obviously a whole bunch of issues that could go wrong or could not get resolved at all. And I think, cleverly perhaps, the State Department has tried to leave itself some kind of margin so they can come up with something on March 31st and then leave the rest for a few... They're kicking it down the can a few more months.
Another extension? Is that what you're saying, Joy?
No.
Kind of looks like it. Kind of sounds like it.
They say not, but, I mean, clearly they're building in time. Well,
what is interesting, though, is that both President Obama, Secretary Kerry, and Zarif, the Iranian foreign minister, have said they really can't do an extension beyond June. So that raises the question. That really does up the pressure here, because if everything collapsed at the end of June, Iran would no longer be under the constraints that they are on under this interim operating agreement. So they could go back to enrich as much as they want.
So tell me how much of a rift you have between the United States and Israel over the prime minister's coming.
A major, major rift. And you hear that in some of the words being used. When Susan Rice calls it destructive, that's quite a strong word to use, destructive to the fabric of the relationship, I believe she said on Charlie Rose. Those are very strong terms to use regarding an ally. And I think it recalls some of the language that was used, for instance, during the Gaza operation last year. You know, outrageous, very strong words to come out of the State Department again, talking about an ally. So that relationship's not in a great place. But it's interesting. We were speaking yesterday on CNN. We had Aaron David Miller, and he was recalling 1991, 92 with George H.W. Bush and Yitzhak Shamir at the time, who had a very, you know, open and public disagreement over settlement buildings, which led to the withholding of a $10 billion loan guarantee for the repatriation of Soviet Jews. So it's not the first time you've had major disagreements between the two, and the friendship has gone on.
I mean, I think a good indication of how bad the rift is the fact that not only has the president said he won't meet with Prime Minister Netanyahu, but as David said, the vice president's going to be out of town, Secretary Kerry's out of town. There's a major pro-Israeli conference happening this week, APEC, which happens every year. And I've looked through the schedule of speakers. I do not see as yet a confirmed high-level U.S. administration speaker.
They just announced it last night, and it's going to be Susan Rice.
Okay.
The woman who, of course, announced the destructive line. It'll be interesting to see what kind of reception she gets. And Samantha Power, the American ambassador to the U.N.
David Sanger, the New York Times. Your questions, comments, when we come back, stay with us.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Constant Contact, committed to helping small businesses succeed with email and online marketing tools for organizations to promote their business through newsletters, events, surveys, and social media. More at ConstantContact.com. From the Joyce Foundation, working to ensure that every student has an excellent teacher and every teacher has exceptional support. More information is available online at JoyceFDN.org. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
On the next Fresh Air, seedy casinos, hardcore gamblers, and high-stakes poker. Colson Whitehead tells us how a magazine recruited him to enter the World Series of Poker and report on the experience. He trained in Atlantic City, found a poker coach, and ended up at the tournament in Las Vegas playing for a chance at millions of dollars. Colson's book is The Noble Hustle. Join us.
We're going to open the phones now. David Sanger of New York Times, Joanna Biddle of Agence France-Presse, and Jim Sciutto of CNN are here with me for the international hour of the Friday News Roundup. Let's go first to Mo in Accokeek, Maryland. You're on the air.
Hey, Mr. Diane. Good morning. Good morning, everybody.
Hi.
Right. So the statement I want to make is that stations like yours, Ms. Diane, and the U.S. government have to take responsibility for some of ISIS spreading around the Middle East, because we overthrew a government that warned us that you don't know the people that we're keeping down. And, you know, there was the statement going around, Gaddafi want to kill his people, or the Syrian president killing his people. Well, we don't understand. These are not their people. These are enemies that want to kill them also. And we got rid of Gaddafi, and Libya, probably one of the best countries in Africa, is probably the worst country today in Africa. So what did we gain? We think he wanted to kill 3,000 people. And I think right now, from the time the war started in Libya till now, it's probably over 30,000 people and no government, stable government in Libya. So what did we accomplish by trying to overthrow people that we didn't like?
Well, I think Mo makes a great point. And when you look at today's Libya, it is a real indictment of the coalition operation to take down the government of Muammar Gaddafi. You have created conditions there that have let these groups thrive. And it's interesting from this administration's perspective, because, of course, they criticized the previous administration for unleashing mayhem in Iraq, which, and of course, this administration is not the only one to make that criticism, and there's a great deal of truth in that. So in a different fashion, though, without an invasion, without a big occupation, the light footprint strategy, the lead from behind, the air campaign, the result has been the same.
All right. To Charles in Bay City, Michigan, you're on the air.
Hello, Diane, and thank you very much for having me.
Sure.
I have some family that they actually lives close to the contact line in eastern Ukraine, and I guess my comment would be that it seems that the Western press, the Western governments, treat Ukraine like a battered wife. You know, don't do anything bad because it might get my drunk husband mad at me. You know, this is a sovereign state that needs the ability to secure its borders, take care of its own people. And, you know, just because it's under or shares the border with Russia, it's almost back in the, not the turn of the century, but, you know, about 50 years ago when Molotov said, we have this sphere of influence and, you know, everyone stay out of it. And I feel this country needs arms. It needs the ability to defend itself, just like Israel or I think any other country in the world.
Well, of course, this goes to the heart of the debate that's happening now within the administration. And I do believe that there are actually, conflicting positions. The Europeans so far have been very, very hesitant about sending arms into Ukraine to Kiev to help them defend themselves against the pro-Russia rebels, simply because this is on their doorstep and they really fear an escalation of the conflict and the violence. And I was at the Munich Security Conference a week ago, and we had this exact same debate, which dominated the conference. And it was very interesting, the split between America and the Europeans on this. And we had a Senator, Lindsey Graham, actually stood up and told Chancellor Angela Merkel that while she was a good ally, she was simply wrong in this stand not to send in arms.
You know, Dan, it's fascinating that this division is not only between the Germans and the United States in some ways, but it's within the administration itself. So just think of what we've heard in the past week at a presentation that he made at the Aspen Institute earlier this week. Tony Blinken, the new Deputy Secretary of State, made the best case that I think one can make within the administration for why it's not terribly useful to send in arms, which is to say they would get there probably too late, too little. But more importantly, we don't have what strategists call escalation dominance. Whatever we send in, the Russians can double or triple. It's not terribly expensive for them. It's on their border, as your caller indicated. Now, on the other hand, you've got some in the administration who say the symbolic damage of not supporting the Ukrainian government is so high that it would only encourage President Putin to go after other states, perhaps including NATO states, Estonia, Lithuania, so forth and so on. And you heard it, some testimony that James Clapper, the director of national intelligence, gave yesterday. He was asked about his own opinion about whether or not to send arms, and he was very careful to say, I'm not a policymaker, because he's in the intelligence world. I'm not speaking for the intelligence community, but in my own personal opinion, I would send it. Now,
then he went on to say it would likely trigger a negative reaction. So he was sort of doing it one way and another.
You know, I was in Ukraine about a week and a half ago. I came back from there alarmed at just the deterioration of the situation. And whether or not the West decides to send arms to Ukraine, it won't change the fundamental fact that you have one side in this conflict, Russia, that is willing to go to war over this, and another side that is not. And Russia knows that. And the trouble is, what as David mentioned, what precedent does that set? And there is real concern among NATO leaders. They will speak about this publicly. Does that tempt action, for instance, against a NATO ally in Estonia, etc.? It's a worrisome question, and it's not answered yet.
Joanna.
Well, yes, indeed. And I think we've seen so far that the ceasefire that was agreed on February the 5th, which came into force on February the 15th, really hasn't held particularly well. I think there was 2 days when there were no casualties. But again, today we saw more fighting. Three Ukrainian soldiers were apparently killed, according to the government. And I was scrolling through some photographs yesterday of the devastation of places in Donetsk and Luhansk, and it is just indescribable.
When do we reach a point where we acknowledge publicly that that ceasefire is not working?
Well, it didn't work certainly in the first week. And, you know, now you've seen some pullback of heavy equipment by the Ukrainians, and because the ceasefire was belatedly beginning to take some effect. I think the biggest concern that I've heard within the administration, Diane, is that Putin's strategy here is sign a ceasefire, as he did months ago, let the rebels, with Russian help, gain another 100 kilometers, go a little further south, begin to get closer to that land bridge, have a crisis, have another negotiation, have another ceasefire, because time is on his side on this one.
Sure. All right. I want to ask you about a kidnapped American woman, Joanna, kidnapped in Nigeria. What do we know? Who was she? Why was she there? Why would she have been taken?
Well, she is a missionary working for the Free Methodist Church. She's worked in Africa, West Africa, for about a decade. She was accompanied at one point by her husband. Her name is Phyllis Sotter. She's a reverend in the church, and she was running a community organization in the school, which is run by the church, actually. She was kidnapped on Monday and by some masked gunmen, and this village where she was kidnapped is actually in central Nigeria. So it's not an area where Boko Haram, the Islamic militant group, is very active. And the feeling at the moment is that she was probably kidnapped by a gang. This has happened on a fairly regular basis in Nigeria. Apparently, her friends said there has been a ransom demand of about $300,000 for her, which has been made via a friend in Nigeria. I think what her fate is or status is right now is unclear, but of course, as we were talking about at the break, Jim mentioned the fear is that she could then get sold on to another group, possibly Boko Haram, in the future.
And that's a precedent we've seen in other war zones, right? Where
exactly.
The for-profit gangs sell them to the ones like ISIS, etc.
All right, to Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, Carl, Anna, you're on the air.
Hi. I'd like to remind everyone that in the 1990s, there was an Israeli prime minister by the name of Yitzhak Rabin, who was a peace person. He wanted to make peace with the Palestinians, and leaving a peace rally, he was assassinated by a fanatic, a Jewish religious fanatic. And his wife, Leah, blamed Netanyahu for her husband's assassination because of the atmosphere of hostility that he had generated against any kind of peacemaking. And so the history of Netanyahu from the assassination of Yitzhak Rabin to the present is one of actions, policies that are extremely destructive. And when we ask why are so many people being recruited from Europe to go fight with these radicals, many of them have been influenced by the news reports they see of Israel abusing Palestinians over these many years. And there are Jewish people who want peace and who would be overjoyed if the Democrats in Congress would not come to listen to Netanyahu. If you go to J Street Organization, many of the peace organizations in the United States and in Israel see Netanyahu as the destruction of Israel and the cause for many Jewish people being killed around the world.
All right, Joanna.
Well, yes, Prime Minister Netanyahu has been around for a very long time. I was in Jerusalem when on the night that Prime Minister Rabin was shot, and I still remember now the visceral shock that ran through that nation, particularly when it was discovered that his killer, his murderer, was a radical Jew. At the beginning, there had been fears that it was, or beliefs that it was, a Palestinian. So Prime Minister Netanyahu, who's been around a long time, they have elections coming up March 17th. I suppose the indications look like he may well win again, but we'll have to see what happens then.
You know, it's a surprisingly closer race on March 17th than we thought a month ago that it would be.
Because people were thinking he was going to lose.
I think initially the thought was that he would win fairly easily. And then I think as the opposition has grown, this race seems to have tightened, you know, a fair bit. So it's hard to predict the outcome. But what is interesting is that the opposition to him includes, for example, as the sort of future defense minister, should the opposition win, a former head of military intelligence whose assessment of the Iranian threat is quite different, even though he, too, is not happy with the deal that is taking shape on Iran. And I think that, you know, this gets right to the schism that is within Israeli society about how you approach these two big issues of the Palestinians and Iran. And, of course, the biggest existential threat that the Israeli state has right now, which is that demographics simply show that at some point they're going to have to choose between a true democracy and thus a much larger Arab population that's going to be voting there and becoming and retaining their status as a Jewish state.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. A U.S. federal court ordered Palestinian groups to pay damages to Americans caught up in terror attacks in Israel. Have we ever seen this before, Jim Shuta?
Well, it's an interesting case because you hold the Palestinian Authority, the PLO, the predecessor Palestinian Liberation Organization, responsible for attacks, terror attacks, many of them by another group, Hamas, which they have their own disagreements with. And it's an interesting precedent, no question. And it'll be interesting how it's enforced and just how it plays into the broader politics there.
It comes at a very bad time for the Palestinian Authority, of course, because they are financially in really dire straits. This agreement, this damages awarded was to the order of something like $280 million. But I believe under U.S. laws, that becomes tripled. So it becomes something like $650 million. I'm not exactly sure why that might be the case. But so, of course, we've already had warnings, stepped up warnings in the last 2 weeks or so that the Palestinian Authority is facing collapse because it cannot simply pay its bills. Israel has withheld taxes from it to the order of around $400 million. International aid is stalling. And the fear is that this added burden could just make it very, very difficult for the authority.
And finally, Joanna, tell us about these mysterious drones flying over Paris. Do we know where they came from?
As yet, we don't, actually. Although, as David said in the break, it's a very good way to see Paris.
They have avoids actually, traffic.
Yeah.
They have actually arrested three Al Jazeera journalists yesterday, but they were arrested for carrying out what I think must be a television experiment in the Bois de Boulogne, which is a beautiful park, wood on the edge of Paris. And it's been made clear that they have nothing to do, or they don't believe they were behind these original drone sightings, which were earlier in the week. We saw apparently drones over the U.S. embassy, drones over the Eiffel Tower.
Right.
Earlier on in the year, we've also seen some drones further afield over nuclear power plants in Brittany, one of the most top secret areas in France. Nobody really seems to know who's behind them, whether they have nefarious plans or whether this is just somebody, some drone fanatic having a bit of fun.
Of course, we know one drone landed on the White House lawn, David.
That's right, which, of course, was commanded by a U.S. Mid-level intelligence official who conceded later on he had a little bit too much
to drink and had sort of lost track
of where this went. But it does get at this point, you know, what people are discussing as drones these days are so small that they go back to, you know, when Jim and I were kids, what you would call radio-controlled aircraft that we, you know.
And in this case, with a pair of glasses, you can actually see below.
Well, you see below because these now have very high resolution, very inexpensive cameras on them with, you know, and
GoPros.
Look, a lot of news organizations, including, I think, all of those represented at this table, have looked at investing in drones for straight-up video.
All right. Well, let's keep drones away from the Capitol and the White House and most of Washington, if we can. David Sanger, Joanna Biddle, Jim Sciutto, thank you all.
Thank you.
Have a great weekend, everybody.
Thanks for listening.
I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkert, Denise Couture, Susan Casey, Rebecca Kaufman, Lisa Dunn, Danielle Knight, Allison Brody, and Alexandra Boti. The engineer is Timothy Olmsted. Natalie Yurev-Lifker answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org.